So, I'd like to begin by discussing the song that we just sang. Well, we just sang many songs, specifically Sri Guru Charana Padma. This song expresses the extraordinary transcendental realization of Narottam Das Thakur regarding the glory of the spiritual master. Is Govinda Dutta here? He asked me to speak about my own pastimes with Prabhupada, so I'll get to that also. But I thought I'd begin by going over this song. It's a very beautiful song, as you know. It begins, Sri Guru Charana Padma, Kevala Bhakati Sadma. It's interesting that in the Vaishnav culture, and even wider, you could say Hindu culture, just for save time. It's not all Vedic, but this custom of using the word Padma or lotus, different words, of course, there are many different words for lotus, to express beauty, to express a sublime quality. So the Charana Padma, of course, we say lotus feet in the Bengali or Sanskrit, the foot lotus. So it's actually considered to be a lotus, but as a foot. Anyway, so Sri Guru Charana Padma, Kevala Bhakati Sadma. Sadma means abode, as in the Chintamani prayer, Chintamani Prakata Sadmasu. So the abode of pure devotion, Kevala Bhakti. Interestingly, from the same word Kevala, which means exclusive or only, that you have the word Kaivalya, which can also mean the impersonal path. So if the word Kevala or Kaivalya from the word Kevala by itself, without devotion, without Krishna, is simply impersonalism, so-called purity, so-called oneness without Krishna. But here is Kevala Bhakti. Prabhupada, I remember one time Prabhupada was giving class here in Los Angeles, New Dwarka, I think in the old temple room, the late great temple room. And during the Bhagavatam class, morning class, he said, Sri Govinda Dutta, we're already doing a Prabhupada story. During the Bhagavatam class, he said, as he would say from time to time, that people give me so much credit for starting this Krishna consciousness movement and taking it all over the world. Because as Prabhupada traveled, of course, people were praising him very much. Not only his disciples, but many other people. And so he said that I don't take any credit for this, but he said, if you want to give me credit for one thing, you can say this about me, that I never tried to take Krishna's position. I never tried. And so, practically, from my experience, Prabhupada was almost the only person on the planet that could really say that, that I never tried to take Krishna's position. It's not that we formally dress up like Pondraka, you know, we hook on two extra arms behind us or have these little sort of tacky, like, dollar store clubs and chakra and lotus and everything. But there's actually a distinction between, well, what I call, in my creation of jargon, there's a distinction between philosophical atheism and psychological atheism. To be a philosophical atheist means that that's your philosophy, that you claim or you state that there is no God. And, of course, the word in Sanskrit for one who claims something or has a particular position is vadi. The Sanskrit root vad means to speak, so vada means speech, and vadi means one who speaks in a certain way, as in mayavadi. So a philosophical atheist is one thing. Then the psychological atheist means that even though I may be a philosophical theist, in my day-to-day life, moment to moment, I'm self-centered. Because actually God is the center. Krishna is the most important person. And so if in my own emotional, psychological life, I'm kind of, if I'm the center of my own life, I mean, there's a sense in which we have to be, otherwise, you know, you'd bump into walls and wouldn't be able to function. But in terms of what we ultimately value and see as important, the extent to which we are proud, the extent to which we take credit for what we do, like I just did something, whatever it may be, the extent to which we take credit for the things we do, to that extent, we are taking credit, we are claiming glory that actually belongs to Krishna. So this first verse, Kevala Vakati Sadma, the abode of pure devotion, to be able to say categorically that I never tried to take Krishna's position, is really a statement that only Prabhupada could make. At least only Prabhupada could make it authentically. So I was thinking the other day that I imagine if you have a very close friend, a very loving friend, and you betray this friend in some way, you cheat this friend because you have a drug addiction. And I was thinking that's actually our position, because when we, for example, lust is like a no-brainer. Because when we are behaving in certain ways out of lust, whether it's gross animalistic lust or even subtle in the form of vanity, in the form of quote-unquote showing off or trying to impress someone of the opposite sex, if one is inclined toward the opposite sex. But anyway, so in terms of lust, or even let's say pride, like taking credit, like, okay, we may officially put in our ISKCON disclaimer, well, that's actually Krishna's mercy, but you did a great job. Yeah, it was Krishna's mercy, but thanks for saying that. So that when we feel that pride, when we feel or that showing off or that lust, there's actually a physiological reality to it, in the sense that the body is actually producing drugs. And so we are actually self-intoxicating. For example, you think of what an attachment is, it's on the one hand, it's an emotional addiction. On the other hand, it's actually a chemical addiction. It's just like, for example, if someone is a drug addict, then there is certainly an emotional addiction, but there's also a physical addiction. And so when we take credit, when we act proudly, when we show off because of lust or other things involving lust, we are actually betraying our best friend, Krishna, because who could be a better friend than Krishna, who gives us everything, including our existence? We are actually betraying Krishna because of a drug addiction. So it's we are in Prabhupada's International Society for Rehabilitation. 16-step program, chant year round. So Prabhupada came to this world. Actually, here in New Dwarka, Prabhupada revealed to me up in his room here once that there never was a time when he didn't know Krishna. I was up in Prabhupada's room with Karunder, former temple president in GBC back in the good old days, and it was an afternoon and the sun was going down. I remember the atmosphere. The sun was going down and somehow like the last golden rays of the sun were coming through Prabhupada's window, and it was a very sublime atmosphere. A breeze was coming in. And Prabhupada was talking to us about his early life when he was a householder. Actually, even earlier. He started talking about his householder life and he sort of kept going back step by step, farther and farther back into his life. I remember he told us that when he was a householder, he had a servant, because in India, you know, especially in the old days, before India became so industrialized, I mean, everyone had servants. So when Prabhupada was a householder, a young householder, he had a servant named Jagadish, and he was explaining how this Jagadish would live almost nothing. He'd live very, very simply, and then he would go and beg some vegetables from Prabhupada's wife, and so his overhead was almost nothing. He saved all his money and then bought some land, and then Prabhupada said then he was never a servant again. So he actually emancipated himself by being very frugal and saving his money. So anyway, then Prabhupada went farther back and talked about his childhood and the famous story. Sounds like a human-like pigeon up there cooing or something. Anyway, so Prabhupada told us that famous story when he did Ratha Yatra as a child. And then Prabhupada looked at us and said, actually he was very serious. He said, I wasn't simply playing, I was very serious. I was actually worshipping Lord Jagannath. So Prabhupada emphasized that it was, and then he said that actually there never was a time when I did not know Krishna. There never was a time when, and then he stared at us, and it was a very heavy moment, and he said, do you understand? And then he repeated it, there was never a time when I did not know Krishna as my Lord, he said, if I remember correctly. So Prabhupada came to this world to rehabilitate us. And these words that we sing every morning, Kevala Bhakti Sadma. Kevala Bhakti is a very challenging idea to actually give up all of our pride and vanity, to really give up our very deep-rooted attachment to our self-centeredness and to take Krishna as everything. So this psychological atheism, or perhaps, you know, Mishra Bhakti, psychological agnosticism, where we are still struggling with the idea of giving everything to Krishna. Whereas in the sense of giving all the credit to Krishna, really accepting Krishna as everything. We are still struggling with that, and of course it's, you know, those who stick to Prabhupada's lotus feet are winning this fight. Gradually we are coming to the point of Kevala Bhakti, but it is the great challenge of human life. When we were young, some of you still are young, actually. I mean, bodily. So I remember when I was young and I joined the Hare Krishna movement and gave up everything, whatever I had, a few possessions I had, and so there was this sensation of giving everything to Krishna, and there was a sort of like euphoric, ecstatic consciousness of just giving everything to Krishna. And that surrender is significant. It's a very significant act. But at the same time, as you get older, you realize that, like, once that euphoria of your initial surrender, I don't want to say wears off, but once you sort of reach your cruising altitude, then the real work begins. Krishna gives us this very generous sort of, you know, introductory bonus. Like when you join a frequent flyer club and they give you 10,000 bonus miles or something. So we join Krishna's movement and we get this introductory offer, this bonus, but then the actual work of purifying ourselves. So we'll go on to this song which describes Prabhupada, Sri Guru Charana Padma. The lotus feet of the Guru, Kevala Bhakti Sadma, are the abode of pure devotion. And so I think this is also very significant, comparing pure devotion to a residence. Comparing pure devotion, I mean, that's something to think about. What does it actually mean to call it a sadma rather than a process, or rather than a state of consciousness? To call it a sadma, an abode. There's another analogous verse in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, where Lord Krishna says that fix your mind in me and engage your intelligence in me. And if you do this, then nivasishasi mayeva, which means literally, you will dwell. You will dwell in me alone. Nivasishasi is just the second person future Sanskrit verb. Singular. If you know the word nivasa, like Sri Nivasa. Sri Nivasa means a dwelling. Actually, vasa also means a dwelling. Like for example, vasa, like the people live somewhere called vasis, like bridge vasis. So vasa means a dwelling. One, if you live somewhere, you are a vasi. And then nivasa is just sort of a synonym. Ni means within. So nivasa, dwelling within a particular place, or dwelling at somewhere. So nivasa And then because the goddess of fortune is always on the embracing the Lord, therefore she's called Sri, or Krishna is called Sri Nivasa. He's the Nivasa, he's the abode of Sri, the goddess of fortune. So anyway, this is the word Nivasa. And then Krishna uses the verb of the same word, nivasishasi, which means you will dwell or you will abide. You know, the word abode and the verb for abode is abide. Bunch of grammar here. So Krishna says in chapter 12 that you will dwell, you will live, you will have your residence in me alone, my Eva. Not only you will, in other words, the only place you will live, your only real address will be in me. So what does this mean? This language is somewhat metaphorical, but it's not, it's also somewhat literal. So what does it mean to dwell, to have your abode in Krishna, or that the lotus feet of Prabhupada, of the Guru, are the abode of pure devotion? So you live. So in other words, pure devotion lives somewhere. Even pure devotion has an address. And the way I understand this is that the experience of being Krishna conscious, when we are, you know, in our better days or better moments, when we are actually experiencing Krishna consciousness, it's an experience, first of all, of Krishna's presence everywhere, and living in a spiritual atmosphere. When we come into the temple, for example, where we have an intense spiritual atmosphere, when we come into the temple room, there is a particular, unmistakable, unique atmosphere, which is intensely spiritual. Or, I mean, wherever you are, if you're whatever you're doing, if you're really Krishna conscious, you really are in that Vaikuntha bubble. You really are in that spiritual atmosphere. And so, even in a spatial sense, you're really living inside of that spiritual atmosphere. And it's a place where we're protected and freed of all anxiety. It really is Vaikuntha, because when we are in that state of consciousness, we really are free of anxiety. So it's in that sense that when we are... Now, obviously, even when Prabhupada was here, we didn't just get like these very large sort of like, skateboards so we could just hang on to Prabhupada's feet and just literally, you know, keep in that horizontal position, follow him as he went around the world. So, I mean, it's... What I mean to say is it's not... When we always talk about the lotus feet of the Guru... Obviously, you can't physically always be at the feet because you could never stand up unless he was on a pedestal or something. So what does it really mean in a non-literal sense? I mean, it also means in a literal sense because we do actually offer obeisances. So we literally physically place ourselves at the feet of the Guru, but then we stand up. And if you offered obeisances and didn't get up, you'd eventually have a bunch of devotees pick you up and carry you out of the temple and take you to some clinic. So we do actually physically offer obeisance. We physically place ourselves at the feet of the Guru as an act of surrender. But at the same time, to be always at the feet of the Guru, which is the abode, because those feet are the abode of pure devotion. Clearly the idea here, the philosophical idea or the poetic idea, is to remain submissive. Because if you think about it physically, when you put yourself at someone's feet, you are under their power. I mean, they can kick you or drop something on you, or and this is understood, I mean, throughout human culture, if you look at ancient civilizations, it's understood everywhere that when you put yourself at someone's feet, you are placing yourself under that person's power. And even physically. And so, to be at the Guru's feet, to be at Prabhupada's feet, means to always remain under his authority. So that our whole life is authorized by Prabhupada, and we do that by only acting in ways that are authorized by him. And also trying to please, because, for example, something may be bona fide. Well, I mean, ultimately, Prabhupada wanted us to be productive. Prabhupada himself was a very active, dynamic person. And we all have our different natures. Some of us are reclusive. Some of us are very extroverted. Some people are artistic. Some people are, you know, like to work with their hands. Some people are intellectual, or some people like to do business. We all have different natures. We have different natures in terms of our vocations. We have different natures in terms of our social skills or propensities, the kinds of relationships, the number of relationships that we like to have, the degree of intimacy that we feel comfortable with different people, and so on. So all of us have our different emotional and vocational natures. Confirmed. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, repeatedly actually, that our duty in life comes from our nature. When you're a young devotee, of course, your nature comes from your duty, in the sense that it's the, you know, do the needful program. And that's good training. It's good to teach obedience and humility and so on. But ultimately, as Krishna repeatedly explains in the Bhagavad Gita, your duty comes from your nature. And so Prabhupada as a pure devotee and as the only person in the world that perfectly understood that we are eternally individual souls. Prabhupada perfectly understood that. He was very compassionate and very respectful even of people's individual natures. And he was very anxious to create a society in which people could be themselves within reasonable limits. I mean, what I mean to say is to be yourself. Just like when Krishna talks about individual natures and duties arising or being literally born from, duties born from nature, it doesn't mean that, well, my nature is to be angry all the time, so therefore I'm going to be angry all the time. Krishna is talking about our basic propensities, vocational propensities, the kinds of careers we want to have, the way we want to work in the world. And Prabhupada understood, actually, better than anyone, that we are eternally individual. And he was very anxious that ISKCON be a place where people could be themselves. He once chastised a devotee who wrote from New York complaining that everyone wasn't just like exactly doing the same thing. And Prabhupada said, that's your impersonalism. That's your impersonalism. So our impersonalism, Prabhupada is Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Deshatarine, saving the Western countries and actually all countries from impersonalism and voidism. So we are not philosophical impersonalists. We do not espouse the philosophy of impersonalism. And yet, if we were completely free from impersonalism, we would be completely pure devotees. And few of us would claim that for ourselves. So just as to the extent that we are not yet perfect in Krishna consciousness, to that extent we still have clear tendencies to want to be God, in the sense of self-centeredness, vanity, taking credit for what Krishna has done. And we also have impersonal tendencies. We also have impersonal tendencies. And Rupa Goswami talks about this, actually, in the Nectar of Instruction, when he uses that term niyamagraha, which the acharyas understand in two different ways. Grammatically, it can be taken two different ways. That niyama, of course, means rules, regulations, and agraha means not grasping. Not grasping, not accepting, not taking the rules, or agraha, which means intensely taking the rules. And so if you think about it, if we try to reduce bhakti yoga down to a set of rules and regulations, a mechanical thing, then it's sort of like the Karmamangsa philosophy, which Krishna himself, we know in the Govardhan pastime, talks about. And when Krishna is explaining to Nanda Maharaj or speaking to Nanda Maharaj about this point of view, what he says is that even Indra is Anisha, not the Lord, or not capable, anyatha karatum, to do otherwise. In other words, It's like, let's say you go to get a driver's license. If you fulfill all the requirements, which are objective and publicly stated, so that you pass the test and you pay the money and so on, they have to give you a driver's license. The person in that particular government office does not have the power, does not have the right to deny you a driver's license if you have actually complied with all the requirements. And so this is essentially the Karmamangsa philosophy, that there is a mechanism within the universe. There is a mechanism within the universe. There is a procedure within the universe such that if you comply, if you fulfill certain requirements, you have to get the result. And the demigods themselves, as Krishna says in Krishna's own words, are anisha. Isha means Lord. Anisha means not the Lord's, or it also means like not capable. You don't have the power. Anyata kartum, to do otherwise. So if we try to reduce bhakti yoga down to a mechanical process, if we think that if I get up at a certain time and go to a certain place and chant and so on, I have to become a pure devotee. Because it's a mechanism. And I can master, because mechanisms can be mastered, whether it's playing a musical instrument or some athletic event or whatever. It's the nature of processes, mechanisms that they can be mastered. And so if we believe that bhakti yoga is simply a mechanism, a process, and I can master it, you can see where this is leading. It's not leading to bhakti. And that's why Rupa Goswami says that if we take this mechanism, this procedure, to be all in all, then that will give us the same result as not following the principles. The same result as not following the principles. We'll lose our Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada really embodied and exemplified the perfect balance between serious attention to the regular principles and at the same time not getting fanatical and hung up about it. Always remembering that people were people. And never forgetting that the rules were not an end in themselves, but they were meant to help people. I mean, this is the same thing, the same principle of not getting, of remembering that it's about people, that the rules are just as, I mean, this is exactly what Jesus said, of course, if to the extent that the New Testament gives us accurate information of the historical Jesus, that where there's some issue about the Sabbath, where in Jewish culture you weren't supposed to do anything on the Sabbath, and Jesus fed people or something like that, and so he was criticized, and he said that the Sabbath is made for man. Man is not made for the Sabbath. In other words, the purpose of the rules is to help people. People don't exist just to exalt the rules or to support the rules. So that, let's say if I follow a certain principle, if I get up early or chant, it's not that I'm doing that just to glorify the rule. Rather, the rule exists so that I can be reunited with Krishna. At the same time, I mean, you can see there's all kinds of subtleties in Krishna consciousness. It really requires a brain. So, at the same time, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Dharma Sangstapanartaya, that I come to this world in order to establish or reestablish Dharma, which is, you know, the law. Dharma is the rules, the laws, the principles, and so on. And so Krishna maintains the prestige of the principles, and yet the principles exist for the benefit of people. And so Prabhupada had this tremendous compassion that if someone, I mean, no matter what they did, Prabhupada exemplified Krishna's own sentiment in the Gita that api chet sudaracharo, even if one behaves very badly, api chet sudaracharo, but bhajate mam ananya bhak, but worships me purely, ananya bhak, which means accepting nothing else but me. Sadhureva samantavya, that person is to be considered sadhu, must be considered sadhu, samyak vyavasito hisaha, because a person has come to the right determination, vyavasito, as in vyavasayatmika buddhir. So, Prabhupada, I saw many times that no matter what anyone had done, if they came and sincerely wanted to follow again, he would treat them with great compassion. There was always another chance. There was always room for everyone if they were loyal to Prabhupada's mission. There's a famous case where Rai Rama, who was one of the early leading devotees in the early days of the movement, he was the first editor of Bhaktivedanta, and he was very, in one sense, close to Prabhupada, and then he went away. And I remember Prabhupada, actually I'll tell one story, which is maybe, I don't know if it's generally known, but in 1969, I was the secretary of the Berkeley Temple, and when I first joined there. And Rai Rama disappeared. In those days, very few devotees had left. So it was like a really shocking thing. I mean, the whole international society, wherever it was, all around the world, wherever it was back then, was kind of like stunned because this one devotee had left. Just because everyone in ISKCON knew everybody else. And even Prabhupada, and then word came that there had been a Rai Rama sighting, and that he had popped up in the Bay Area. And so Prabhupada quickly sent a letter, and sent a letter to the Berkeley Temple, and then as a secretary, I was supposed to give this letter to Brahmananda, who was supposed to then somehow give it to Rai Rama. It was a letter from Prabhupada. And I have to admit, we were so attached to Prabhupada, we were so like, the movement was so, that I held the letter up to the light. I wanted to see what Prabhupada said. I didn't go to the extreme of, steaming it open. But I did hold it up to the light, and I remember I was shocked at what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada said that ever since you left, I'm crying every night because you're gone. And Prabhupada was so personal. And then Rai Rama actually came back after a while. And this is very interesting. And so when he came back, though, he said that he'd become involved in some type of maybe a vegetarian Christian group or something, or I hope it was vegetarian, but anyway. And then he told Prabhupada he wanted to live in the temple, I think New York temple, but he wanted to continue with this parallel worship that he had taken up. So he wanted to live in the temple and sort of do Krishna consciousness, but also maintain this other process that he'd become attached to. And Prabhupada told him, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't live in the temple like that. So it's interesting. Here's someone that Prabhupada really had so much affection for. And in those days, not living in the temple was almost like, not being in the Hare Krishna movement. We were so mature in those days. But so anyway, Prabhupada said, no, you can't live in the temple. So if someone came to Prabhupada and really was willing to follow him, to actually follow him, then there was always room. And of course, even Rai Rama, he didn't reject Rai Rama. He didn't say you can't chant Hare Krishna. He just said that you can't live with us under those circumstances. So Sri Guru Charana Padma came. So by sticking to Prabhupada, by being loyal to Prabhupada, faithful to Prabhupada, by dedicating our lives to his mission, we are living within pure devotional service. Because pure devotional service lives. The abode of pure devotional service is service to Prabhupada. So that's what we experience this. It's not just poetry in the sense that, for example, this temple's in Los Angeles and there are temples all around the world. But you can go to any serious temple around the world and you're in the same place if you actually understand Krishna. You can go to any, serious temple where they're actually following and doing things seriously. And you're really in the same place. There's a sense in which, every little neighborhood in Vaikuntha has its own taste and flavor, but still you're basically in the same region, the region of pure devotional service. So Prabhupada could do that. And to quote, then the reason Prabhupada could do it is because the reason Prabhupada could create a movement which of pure devotional service is because of his own pure devotion. In that famous verse, Tadvidhi Pranipatena, which we translate just to learn the truth by approaching a bona fide spiritual master, Krishna. What Krishna literally says is, upadekshanti te gyanam gyaninas. He juxtaposes the two words, gyanam and gyaninas. And he puts these two words together to make a point, an obvious point, where Krishna says, they will teach you knowledge who have knowledge. They will teach you knowledge. They will instruct. Upadesha, you know, upadeshamrita. This is just the verb, upadekshanti. They will instruct. So they will teach you knowledge who have knowledge. And Krishna puts these two words together, jnanam, jnaninas. Tattva darshan, those who have seen the truth. So Prabhupada not only had pure devotion for Krishna, but he had it so strongly. He had so much pure devotion for Krishna that he could invest an entire international society with his own pure devotion. So that even though we are still works in progress, by serving Prabhupada's mission, we actually come under that, what one scholar has called the sacred canopy. We come under the shelter. We come into that atmosphere of pure devotion. So within Prabhupada's mission, ISKCON, even though we are works in progress, we are, you know, on the road, still, we are living and working in an atmosphere of pure devotion. And that's the extraordinary quality of Lord Chaitanya's movement. We are actually living and working in the atmosphere of pure devotion, despite our own imperfections. So that's the meaning of these words, Sri Guru Charna Padma Kevala Vakati Sadma. And then Bandho Muin, I worship or honor or revere the Guru's lotus feet. Savadhana Mate, this is very interesting. Savadhana, if you are in Bengal, West Bengal, if you're on the road, and of course you probably should wear the crash helmet even if you're in a car. That's another thing, you know, the experience of driving in West Bengal. But apart from that, when you're in West Bengal, on the road, just like in America, they have signs that say caution. So the caution signs in Bengali say Savadana. That's the caution sign. You know, the road sign caution, it's Savadana. As we sing, Bandhumi Savadana Mate. So Avadana. Avadana in Sanskrit means attention, like paying attention. And Sa means with. So Sa Avadana means with attention. So just as when you're driving on the road, especially in West Bengal, you really have to pay attention. That's why they put up caution signs, because you're in a situation where there is danger and a significantly reduced margin for error. That's why they put up caution signs. So devotional service has often been compared to a journey. In fact, one of the oldest Vedic metaphors is that the body is a car, rata, and you know, the senses are the horses, and the mind are the reins, the driver is the intelligence, soul is the passenger. So this human life, in one of the oldest of all Vedic metaphors, has been compared to a vehicle in motion. And this is a very common metaphor found throughout our literature. And of course, the marga is a path, right? It's a road. Calling the devotee, you know, a particular lifestyle, a path, is a very ancient image, certainly found in our culture. So, on the road, you have these caution signs, Savadana. So, it's very interesting. It's very interesting language that I worship the lotus feet of the Guru, Savadana, with caution, with attention. In other words, we have to really pay attention to what we're doing, be very careful. Probably called it the razor's edge. Well, it's almost 8:20. We've done the first verse of 8. So, any questions? Several people told me that there's no breakfast today, so I can indulge myself. But are there any questions so far on these points? Yes. It's both. Yeah, it's attachment has both an emotional and a physical component.
I wanted to maybe you could elaborate on it if possible.
Well, when a person becomes sexually agitated or aroused, the body actually releases these endorphins, these drugs. The body produces these drugs. Not simply in a state of like gross animal lust, but even in the, you know, the somewhat more subtle state of when you're kind of like vanity, like showing off, or this person likes me, and you get that cheap thrill. So it's that whole rush, that sort of like that pleasure, that excitement, that of thinking that you're thinking that you are attractive to a person to whom you are attracted, is literally a drug experience. You're literally DUI. I mean, you're driving under the influence. If the body is a chariot or a vehicle, then when our lust arises, either subtly or grossly, we are DUI. You know, you can't blow up a Vaikuntha balloon or walk a straight line or touch the nose on your spiritual body. So I think it's helpful to remember that when we are sort of under the influence like that of lust or pride or so on, that we are intoxicated. We are under the influence of drugs and not in our right minds. And so that's what we're doing. We're sort of giving up Krishna consciousness for a drug experience. Oh, someone in the back there? Someone up here? I think you. First, someone right here? Yes. That person there in the dhoti. That was a joke. Okay, yeah, right. The blue sweater, you want to see?
Wouldn't Krishna's consciousness, a human coming into Krishna consciousness, that purifying, isn't that also a neurochemical journey?
Interesting question. This brings up a very interesting point. Prabhupada, of course, always talked about conditioned life. We're conditioned souls. The word used often, conditioned. And so what does the word condition literally mean? It means that under certain conditions, you respond mechanically. We discussed this in my last lecture I gave here on Sunday, that the tension between freedom and necessity. So, again, a simple example that if I let go of this hat, here it goes. Ready? 1, 2, 3. So the hat has no freedom. It necessarily falls. It necessarily falls. And so the problem, this is very interesting. Actually, I think I just had an interesting realization. This is like totally spontaneous. That the price we pay when we identify with matter, the body, is that we actually start to become like matter. In other words, it is the nature of matter that it has no free will. It has no free will. It simply obeys necessarily, not freely, the laws of nature. So that to be a conditioned soul means that even though I'm a free soul, I start to become like dead matter in the sense that under certain conditions, I necessarily act in certain ways. So that, for example, if someone freely chooses, let's say, to take an addictive drug, if someone freely chooses to take heroin, and the person is not a heroin addict, they just freely choose, exhibiting extraordinary intelligence, they freely choose to take heroin. The reason certain activities are called sinful is because when you perform them, the activity destroys the very freedom that enabled you to choose it. To become a drug addict means that although you initially chose to take that drug, as your addiction comes on, you lose your freedom and you become no more intelligent than this dead matter here in my hand, and you have to do certain things necessarily, you lose your freedom. The same thing is true with sex addictions or just attachment. The nature of attachment is that it destroys my freedom. I am forced to do something. Now, Krishna consciousness, which you mentioned, is actually a very good question, is exactly the opposite. Because when you freely choose to perform Krishna consciousness, it expands your freedom. It expands your freedom. In other words, you become free from mechanical attachments or conditioning where I'm forced to do something. So that in Krishna consciousness, even let's say if I'm attached to Krishna and every morning I get up and chant Hare Krishna, but every morning I'm choosing to do that freely. And I'm doing it with my intelligence. Another difference between, so they're actually opposite. I mean, we have free will. So in a sense, let's say choosing spiritual life or choosing material life, in a sense they occur at the same place. I mean, the choice, because you're in a particular point in your life and you make a choice this way or that way. Once you make the choice, you go in opposite directions. So that another thing is that Krishna uses a very interesting word in the Bhagavad Gita, which is a term, actually. It's two words. Buddhigrayam. Krishna, in that verse, which Prabhupada used to quote a lot in the early days in New York, that yam labdhva chaparam labham manyate nadikam tata, that when you achieve this pleasure, you realize there's no greater pleasure, because he was preaching all these hippies in New York. So he talked about pleasure. When you achieve this pleasure, you realize there's no greater pleasure. And Krishna talks about that spiritual pleasure as buddhigrayam, which literally means acceptable to intelligence. Acceptable to intelligence. And so, if I have a material attachment to whatever, if I sit down and really think about it, I'm going to understand that this is irrational, self-destructive, miserable, and the only possible outcome is frustration and suffering. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, rajasastu phalang dukam, that misery is the result of passion. So, you make your free choice. But Krishna consciousness expands your intelligence, expands your freedom. Whereas when I choose material sense gratification, it actually makes me stupid. It stupefies me. And the only way I can pursue a material attachment, a bodily attachment, is by sort of turning my brain off or deluding myself and imagining that all kinds of things are true, which in fact are not true. So they're just the opposite. In one case, one truly becomes a conditioned soul, very much like a rat in a laboratory. The bell, like a dog, the bell rings and I salivate. Whereas Krishna consciousness is just the opposite, increases intelligence and freedom and self-empowerment. Oh, I didn't know that. The first time I heard that.
Okay. So I'm wondering if we can end the question-answer period, and we can have some of the other speakers speak at this time, because we have probably Abhishek at 9 o'clock also.
That's fine, of course.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's the first time I've heard that.
So thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Swamala Bhakta Prabhu will be invited to speak at this time. Thank you.
Up here? I'll go back there so people can sit up here.
Hare Krishna. I'll approach some of the other devotees if they would like to speak. We'll begin with, of course, the older devotees. And if I don't approach you, please come and approach me. And then, of course, at 9 a.m. we have the Abhishek. And then afterwards, after the Abhishek, which I think lasts around 20 minutes or so, and then we'll watch a video that Siddhanta Prabhu has prepared on Srila Prabhupada's passing and some of the devotees that were present there. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada's disappearance observance key time.
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devam Gaudavani Pacharane Nirvashesha